It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a fine day for a march.
It is.
It is.
It's a beautiful day out there.
It's a nice spring day. Good day to get out and enjoy the sunshine. And
it's spring.
And complain.
Is it?
Express your opinion.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Exercise your democratic rights while we still have them.
Out in the streets as opposed to what most of us probably do, just, you know, in
yes,
the comfort
exactly.
of our homes.
Exactly.
Or with our coworkers
yeah.
or whatever.
Today, for people who aren't catching the reference, the anniversary of the war in Iraq, of course, the invasion happened a year ago yesterday. And today, all over the world, in fact, many of them have already been happening in different parts of the world, close to 500, probably over that, when you count in the number that aren't up on the official website of marches and demonstrations and other commemorations of the war in Iraq and calling for an end to the war now and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Happening all over the world, a very, very large march in New York City today, a large regional one at Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and at least a dozen that are happening in Washington State, including several in our neck of the woods.
Yeah. Today, here in Seattle, there's a rally and march. There are workshops, actually, beginning at 10:30 at Seattle First Baptist Church at 1111 Harvard Street. That's at Harvard and Seneca. And then at 11, there's going to be an interfaith service with the keynote speaker is Ed Asner. And then there'll be a march at noon down to Pier, is it Pier 92, 93?
62, 63.
Yeah. 63.
And, you know, I got to say, I can remember being camped out in the ditch that was a sad excuse for a place to huddle out in front of the gates of Pantex Nuclear Weapons Assembly Plant in the panhandle of Texas in the mid-80s. And the big draw was Ed Asner is coming to speak. it's like, can't they find somebody new that's like been on TV in the last 20 years? But
cut him some slack.
No. I mean, I'm glad he's coming out. It's great that, but it's like there's many, many other good reasons to come too.
That's true. That's very true.
And there are also rallies happening in other places where our signal are being heard. There's one in Tacoma that's happening today as well. That is at 1 o'clock, and that's at McKinley Park is where people will be gathering there, and there will be a march from there down to the federal courthouse. Information for that, if you want information, is at www.UFPPC, that's United for Peace of Pierce County, .org. And I believe it's www.mer20th.org for Seattle. And then in Olympia, there's a couple of them. There's one that's just about getting ready to start in a few minutes. A drumming this is very Olympia. That's happening at 9 o'clock at Heritage Park. That's at the Capitol Lake waterfront of Legion Avenue and Water Street. And then the main rally will be at noon, gathering at the Capitol Hill lawn at 12th and Capitol Way, and marching from there. And I love how they have this described on the website as a short march through downtown Olympia. It's like, yeah, that would be short. Going to Sylvester Park. That's the name of it. Sylvester Park. And the website for that is omjp.org, Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace.org. And both of those groups are fine groups in Tacoma and Olympia for ongoing peace and justice activities as
yeah.
well.
And we'll repeat these at the end of the half hour. So
get your pencil and papers ready, as they say on Counterspin.
And if yes. you can't wait, you can check out Gene Buskin's calendar at www.scn.org/activism/calendar. And she has all that on her website.
Yeah, and it's also a very good source on an ongoing basis for peace and justice events, because it's not just marching, it's also organizing that will get this war stopped.
All right, well, jumping into this week's news, James Yee has to be a happier person today than he was earlier in the week.
Yeah, well, you had to see this coming, and it's happened.
Who is James Yee again?
It's happened now several times in the Bush administration, where there were these high-profile accusations of people being busted in the war on terror or being busted for espionage. In the case of James Yee, he was a chaplain at Guantanamo Bay, a Muslim chaplain, in fact, one of the Army's few Muslim chaplains. And he was accused, and it was breaking news on CNN and Fox and all the networks, that he was accused of espionage and trading in state secrets with some of these prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. And the government's case has been steadily falling apart for months now, and yesterday, without much fanfare, the government abruptly announced that it was dropping all charges. They had already thrown out the most serious espionage charges. They had decided that those just didn't hold any water, and it had been reduced to lesser charges, and then tacking on some additional charges like, using pornography as though there weren't a fine tradition of this throughout the armed forces, and adultery, and various other things that usually don't make the front page of the New York Times when they when they're announced by the Army.
When was the last time someone was convicted of adultery in the United States?
Yeah, and for this, Yee spent 76 days in solitary confinement. His reputation, of course, was nearly destroyed. It's very reminiscent of the scientist at Los Alamos about a year and a half previous, who was dragged through the mud.
Wen Ho Lee, another Chinese American.
Who was again kept in solitary confinement, again, accused of espionage, and was finally exonerated. In this case also, Yee has been completely exonerated. His wife and child live in Olympia. He was stationed in Fort Lewis, so there are some local connections here also. But what was really notable about this case, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, was one of the reasons that Yee was targeted to begin with is the situation at Guantanamo and the fact that he was talking with prisoners. He was one of the few people who was talking with civilians about, particularly members of the families of some of these people at Guantanamo, about what was happening at Guantanamo Bay and how the United States was treating some of these prisoners, because he's one of the few people that's been allowed to see it.
Yeah. The real reason why Yee has been pursued by the U.S. government is because they cannot allow anyone outside to know what's going on there. Now,
which raises the question of what we're doing and whether there'll be anybody waiting for us when we leave the station at the end of the day.
No. But this week was an interesting week because three Britons who had been held at Guantanamo Bay were released into British custody this week.
The first people who have been released.
Well, not the first people, but the first adults that have been released.
Okay.
Now, there were some children that were held at Guantanamo or who were held in separate facilities and treated rather well compared to the adult prisoners at Guantanamo who were released after a couple of years in the U.S. military finally admitting that, gosh, a 13-year-old boy really is not a terrorist. Those kids were released and allowed and sent back to Afghanistan, allowed to go home. However, these are the first adults.
But only after a lot of international outcry. Actually.
Right. Yeah. And these are the first adults that were released into British custody. They were questioned for a couple of hours by British police and then let go completely. No charges, nothing. As far as the British authorities are concerned, these guys are just fine. They're free. And they have been talking to the British press. They talked to the London Observer last Sunday. And the London Observer, if you have a chance to go online and check it out, has a great couple of great articles on what these guys experienced, not just at Guantanamo Bay, but in the run-up to getting there, what happened when they were prisoners of the Northern Alliance. Troops are our allies.
Yeah, www.observer.co.uk.
Yeah. So folks should go online and check that out. And it's no surprise that these guys all talked about the torture that's going on in Guantanamo and also talked about not just the camp that we know is there, but a secret camp that holds the higher security guys at Guantanamo, the guys who actually might have some connection to Al-Qaeda and to the Taliban. Those men are being held in 24-hour-a-day solitary confinement, 365 days a year, which is contravenes the Geneva Convention treatment of prisoners and is also illegal under international law.
Yeah, not that these are prisoners and not that we have to pay attention to international law,
Just
in case anybody's concerned about those formalities.
Yeah, they also talked about routine beatings, having guns held to their head while they were questioned, and other forms of torture that occurred not just at Guantanamo, but at U.S. facilities in Afghanistan before they were sent to Guantanamo. So it's very interesting stuff, and the U.S. government does not want any of that to leak out to not just the families of people who are there, because there are many people who don't even know if their relatives are being held at Guantanamo, because the U.S. military will not release a list of names of the detainees at Guantanamo. They don't want the information to go out to the lawyers who could represent these people, and particularly do not want this information to get into the hands of the media.
Yeah, and why is it once again that now that we have people who are free to walk the soil, who are out on the streets, who can talk about these conditions, the British media is interested in their story, but the American media does not seem to be.
Some of the British media. The Observer interviewed him, but has the BBC? No.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, in that article it said that they estimated each of them had been interrogated at least 200 times.
Yeah.
And not just by U.S. military intelligence, but by the CIA, the FBI, MI5, and MI6. So British intelligence knew that they were there. And at the same time that members of the British government were saying they were doing their best to get these guys released, there were members of the British government who were doing their best to keep them incarcerated.
Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. Elections in Spain.
Yeah, speaking of media and the what happens when stories actually do leak out, the elections in Spain were remarkable this week for a couple of different reasons. One was the aftermath of the terrorist bombing in Madrid last week that killed at least 200 people, and we talked about this at some length last week on this program, how the government under Aznar was immediately claiming you know adamantly that this was the work of separatists. That they had conclusive evidence, and as you heard on Counterspin in the last half hour, for folks who were listening then, that the mainstream Spanish media by and large went along with this. What happened was that many of the people within Spain who were accessing foreign media, who were accessing the internet, started reading that there was quite a bit of evidence that it wasn't the work of the ETA or Basque separatists at all. It appeared to be the work of Islamists and with possible connections to Al-Qaeda. And the more that the word of this spread, and the more that the word is eventually leaked out that the government didn't have a leg to stand on when it came to its claims that it was the work of Basque separatists, there was really it really contributed to a lot of mass anger, and it really helped swing a very fairly close election away from the incumbent Aznar and toward the Socialist Party, even though there really wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm for the Socialists going into the election. But at the same time, the other significant difference, of course, was the Spanish government's support of the war in Iraq. And that was extremely unpopular within Spain. For folks who can remember the last day where there was huge worldwide demonstrations against the war, that included an estimated 2 million people in Madrid, an estimated 1 million people in Barcelona, which is a city that doesn't even have a million people in it. I mean, it's just extremely widespread displeasure with the war on terror for Spain's part on it, which has not really changed much in the last year. In fact, probably has deepened because of Spanish casualties in Iraq. And so, you know, between those two factors, the U.S. people could learn an awful lot from the electorate in Spain, where you have a government that tried to take immediate political advantage out of a terrible terrorist attack that was unprecedented in the country's history, although it helped, I think, that the Spanish people do have a memory of 40 years of fascist rule in the Spanish Civil War, so they have some context in which to place political violence. But they did not immediately go toward rallying the flag. They did not immediately go toward an unquestioning belief in what their government leaders said. They paid attention to what the evidence was. They asked what the motives of the bombers could be. They looked at the evidence, and they decided that their leaders were lying to them. And they voted them out of office as a consequence. And that's something that we could stand to learn from.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, too, that the Socialist candidate, even though the name of his party is the Socialist Party, really financially, fiscally, is not much of a socialist. I mean, this is a guy who supports free markets, the integration of Europe. He has an economic advisor who went to school here in the United States and is pro-free market.
And not just anywhere in the United States, but I think it was at Harvard.
I think it was the Harvard Business School. And the Spanish people did not vote for him because he's a socialist. They voted for him because he said, the war in Iraq is wrong. If I'm elected, I'll bring the troops home. Now, it is an example we should follow. However, it would be nice if we had a candidate who would say the same thing here, Kerry, we're waiting.
Yep. And again, turning out today might have something to do with helping to apply the pressure or give him the political courage to actually say something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's true.
All right. Well, moving along, the war on terrorism.
Yeah, it's an anniversary today. It's the 1 year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and I thought I would give folks a little information on the toll in the war on terrorism so far. Just the toll in Iraq, the number of dead U.S. troops since March 20th of 2003, 572 have died, 393 in combat. Since May 1st, when George Bush landed on the aircraft carrier and said that the war was, for most purposes, over, 432 U.S. troops have died, 281 of those in combat. Since December, when Saddam Hussein was captured and U.S. military planners said, well, we've got a lid on this insurgency thing,
it'll die away.
That's right. 114 troops have died, 81 of those in combat. Should note that that's mostly since the beginning of the year, and that's on average about one U.S. soldier a day. 101 coalition troops have died in Iraq. That's British soldiers from places as far-flung as Australia, Thailand, also Poland and Spain. Excuse me. IraqBodyCount.org gives the total of Iraqi civilian dead at between 8,581 to 10,430. They give a range because it's hard to tell sometimes from press reports how many people have actually died, and they do only count from press reports, and I should note that a lot of the press is not covering a lot of the Iraqi civilian dead, so that's a very conservative estimate.
And we should also note, I mean, the underlying fact of all of that, which is the government of Iraq, which is to say the government of the United States, has no interest in counting the number of dead.
And that's where many of the press reports come from, is they come from reporters covering what the U.S. military has announced as the dead in these various incidences. I also want to add the 200 dead in last week's bombing in Spain as casualties of the Iraq war. Also, we should talk about the number of wounded American troops, which many people have said have been far undercounted. UPI, Universal Press International, has reported that at the Landstuhl Air Base, where most of the evacuated wounded U.S. troops go when they're removed from the region, has treated some 11,754 U.S. soldiers. 9,651 of those are from the war in Iraq, and the rest are from the war in Afghanistan. This week, the Associated Press reported that 660 people have died just from suicide bombings in Iraq. And that, again, is a conservative estimate because it's based on press reports reported by the U.S. military, which doesn't always care about the number of Iraqi civilians who are killed in any incident, particularly the suicide bombings. There was a particular instance of that this week when a bomb went off outside of a hotel in downtown Baghdad. The U.S. military claims that 7 people were killed. While reporters on the scene reported initially 27 people, the toll has risen from their reports, and so that's a direct example of how the U.S. military undercounts the dead in these incidences.
Yeah, and one other thing about these numbers also is that if you're comparing them with, for example, Vietnam or with other past wars, the instances of dead and wounded, and one of the reasons people think the wounded toll is much higher is that because of medical advances, because of advances particularly in the ability to do medical triage on site in terms of wounded, a lot more soldiers and U.S. military personnel are surviving these bombings than would have 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. But at the same time, the conditions in Iraqi hospitals are so primitive, so understocked, so they really have not recovered from the effects of the war and the effects of a decade of economic sanctions, that a number of the civilians that are caught inside these suicide bombings are dying of their wounds, and they're dying days or weeks after the initial press reports happen about the tolls.
Yes, that's very true. I also want to point out that the estimated 660 dead in Iraqi suicide bombings is more than the 474 people who have died in suicide bombings in Israel and Palestine over the last 3.5 years of the Intifada. That's an interesting comparison, I think. Now, we talk about the casualties in Iraq, but we tend to forget that there's another war going on in Afghanistan and has been going on since late 2001. That's more than 2 years, almost 2.5 years of a war that is still continuing in a much smaller country as far as population size. 114 U.S. troops have died in Afghanistan in a war that is still continuing. And the three British detainees that were released from Guantanamo have also said that they experienced and they witnessed the death of thousands, in one of them said tens of thousands, of prisoners of the Northern Alliance troops, our allies in Afghanistan. Now, there have been counts or attempted counts of the number of civilian dead in Afghanistan, and those have also been based on press reports. I think folks ought to take a look at what these guys have to say about the dead that they witnessed as well. Those reports would be revised from a couple thousand up to tens of thousands.
Yeah, and as you can recall, when the invasion of Afghanistan was taking place, and we were talking on this program a couple years ago about the reports that were coming out of mistreatment of prisoners by Northern Alliance, by some of these different warlords who were given fancy titles and a lot of new weapons by the U.S.
Who now run the country?
Run the country? Yeah, and you know. That has really disappeared from public consciousness, and it's a shame because a lot of that same type of mistreatment is going on, and the people responsible for it are now in great positions of power, as you say.
Yeah, I also want to remind folks, too, that not only do these warlords now run Afghanistan, but Hamid Karzai came out just this week, and he said, I'm sorry, but Hamid Karzai is the interim president of Afghanistan. He said this week, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to delay the elections. And why are they delaying the elections? Because the UN has only registered about an estimated 10% of the eligible population of Afghanistan to vote. And they haven't been able to register the other 80 to 90% because of security.
Because they can't leave Kabul.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, they can leave Kabul, but only very limited parts of the country. Most of the people registered in the country have been in Kabul. It's like an estimated 2 to 3% of the country outside the capital.
That's right. And the war in Afghanistan, I want to reiterate, is still going on. This week we've seen Operation Mountain Storm. That's the latest military operation going on in eastern Afghanistan and western Pakistan in order to supposedly root out the last remnants of the Taliban and try to find Osama bin Laden for once and for all. However, press reports, while the U.S. military has said, well, we have captured and killed a number of foreign terrorists and guys with links to al-Qaeda, press reports on site have shown that the numbers of dead, which are approaching 100 or more, the numbers of dead people are increasing daily in this operation, and that all of the dead are local tribesmen. They are not Taliban. They are not members of al-Qaeda. They are not foreign terrorists. And the reason these guys are being killed, largely, as I can gather from reading these press reports, is because they don't have foreign terrorists to turn over to the Pakistani military. The reason they're dying is because they have maintained some autonomy from the central government of Pakistan and Afghanistan for not just decades, but for centuries. It's basically punishment for them not allowing themselves to be ruled by a corrupt government.
Yeah, and if you go and take a look at a world atlas and see the mountainous area and what's called the Northwest Frontier, it's not a province but a territory really in Pakistan that is not centrally ruled by the federal government there. The reason for that, it's a real mountainous area. It's quite remote, and historically they have maintained their independence. Since the days of the Mongol hordes coming down from the north and all the different conquistadors that come from different directions in that part of the world, they have been fiercely independent for centuries, for millennia, and they're not about to be impressed by U.S. Army personnel. coming in there with guns, yeah. And it's costing them their lives.
That's right, and it's displacing hundreds of civilians, of people in villages nearby as well. Now, I want to move on to this week in Iraq.
Please do.
Okay. The U.S. coalition is beginning to fall apart, as folks have probably guessed. It's not just the Spanish troops that are ready to be pulled out of Iraq. The Polish president this week also said, you know, I think we were lied to. I think we were misled when the U.S. government came to us and said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we may need to rethink about keeping Polish troops in Iraq. And that sent the Bush administration into a panic.
Yeah, if you want the list of foreign leaders who think that Bush should not be reelected, you know, go consult the roster of the UN, because there's about 190 of them.
That's right. And then this week also, South Korea's defense ministry announced that they were refusing to send troops to the city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq, where the U.S. wants to send South Korea's some 3,000 troops that South Korea was going to deploy in Iraq in the next couple of weeks, next 2 to 4 weeks. And that's going to put a delay on sending South Korean troops over there until the U.S. military finds a place where they can deploy them, that where they will actually be able to perform not an offensive mission, which is what the U.S. wanted to use them for, but a defensive and peacekeeping role. That's going to take a while, I think. The only other thing I wanted to talk about for this week in Iraq is General Jay Garner this week told the BBC... first of all, I want to remind folks of who General Jay Garner is. They may not remember who he was. He was the first viceroy of Iraq, the guy who was running things before Paul Bremer was put into place over there. Jay Garner told the BBC this week that he was fired by the Bush administration because he wanted to hold free elections as soon as possible in Iraq, and the Bush administration could not and did not want to do that. Also, Jay Garner said that he had objected to the privatize all of Iraq's natural resources as soon as possible.
Which is a plan very closely related to the reason they don't want elections very quickly.
Yes, uh-huh. The two go hand in hand. And General Jay Garner said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. So they got rid of him and put Paul Bremer in his place. Now, you can imagine how things might have gone differently if Garner had been allowed to hold elections right away and had been allowed to stop the privatization plan and had not done what Paul Bremer did, which was send all of those Iraqi troops home with their weapons in order so that they could just turn right around and become insurgents.
All right. Well, with that, we're coming up close on the end of the show, but there are things for people to do today.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the ways things might have been different, there might have been a lot fewer dead in the last year, and there might be fewer dead in the coming year. And the goal, of course, is to try and create a movement in this country as well as around the world that that can put an end to this war by convincing the U.S. government to pull its troops out, because that's really the only thing that will do it. Again, marches today in Olympia, in Tacoma, and here in Seattle. The one in Seattle starts on Capitol Hill at noon at the corner of Harvard and Seneca. March down the hill through downtown to the waterfront, where there will be a 1 o'clock rally at Pier 62.
Join those longshore workers.
Exactly.
I understand they closed the port in San Francisco.
Yeah, there was also a march through the financial district this morning, apparently.
Yeah,
that was sort of spontaneous
in
San Francisco that shut things down. So that'll be at Pier 62 and 63 at 1 o'clock. In Tacoma, they'll be marching.
That's it.
Starting
McKinley Park at McKinley Avenue and East D Street.
Yeah, and that's at 1 o'clock. And at noon in Olympia, they'll be gathering at Capitol Lawn, and they'll be marching down to Sylvester Park.
All right. Well, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around town. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to donate, you can go to our website, or you can give us a call at 206-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-903-